Jordan began to wax nostalgic about his early days spent meandering about on his old Mongoose scooter. Chasing that nostalgia, he started looking for something similar to the scooter of his youth. But after some quick research, he realized that most scooters were just not as awesome as he remembered. An all too common problem with nostalgia. But then he discovered a company called Kickbike, which takes all the best aspects of scooters and bikes, combining them into a single recreational product. Based in Helsinki, Finland, Kickbikes had been a growing sensation through much of Europe for over 25 years. They call themselves the Porsche of the scooter industry, perhaps a bit of a stretch, but they do have a passionate fan base. Despite their international success, Jordan had never seen a Kickbike in the United States. He couldn't believe that this fad hadn't caught on yet, so he began to research the company. What he found was that the owner of Kickbike America actually lived right there in Florida, just a few hours away in Orlando. Jordan drove down for a meeting and asked if they could come to an arrangement that would lead to him being able to use the bikes on 30A. He felt that the business had a lot of potential for growth, so he offered to assist the owner in building up his brand presence. With years of experience in web design and marketing, Jordan proposed a trade. He would completely revamp the Kickbike US website and manage the marketing campaign for him. In return, the owner would give him some kickbikes and a commission on all online kickbike sales in the United States. Before he knew it, Jordan was heading back to 30A feeling victorious. He was towing a U-Haul containing his first 25 kickbikes. But the real work began when he arrived home. His vision was to turn this truck full of kickbikes into the next big thing in the next big destination. The 30A road runs along a coastline dotted with a dozen vibrant little beach communities that each boast their own unique vibe and flavor. Jordan thought the kickbikes would provide the perfect vehicle for a fun, active tour that would enable people to get off 30A and see another side of this incredible place he called home. Following the exposure that the area received when the Truman Show came out, this 13-mile stretch of road that had previously been a well-kept secret was quickly becoming a major tourist destination. But despite the growing tourism trend, no one was offering tours of the area. Jordan had spent 2 full years exploring every inch of his new home, the rare coastal dune lakes, the state forests and parks, and all of the accessible trails, in addition to every business and street in each town. He'd made himself into an authority of the area, and he used his knowledge to create customized tours. Getting his Florida business license and liability insurance was easy and inexpensive, but finding retail space in the area was much more of a challenge. Space was technically available, but it wasn't cheap. Not one to be dissuaded, Jordan started out by operating off the back of his truck in parking lots, and leaving some of his kickbikes parked in high foot traffic areas with flyers detailing how to get in touch with him to schedule. He strategically tailored his tours based on the fitness level of those who signed up. Kickbiking is more fitness intensive than bicycling, so he tried to fill out the expectations of his customers in order to ensure that it was a positive experience for everyone. Some tours sold better than others, so as time went on, he focused on those and dropped the more experimental ones. He also developed relationships with local businesses, and several of them ended up allowing him to use their shops as official starting points for the tours. This was a win-win, bringing new business to the shops while allowing him to forego paying for a rental space. These days, the Kickbike side hustle is well past the kickoff point. Jordan ended up leaving his remote work position to freelance as a web developer, and his tours and commissions are bringing in an additional $3,000 to $5,000 a month. He's now thinking about what comes next. Maybe he'll roll his way into markets where the adult scooter trend hasn't yet kicked its way down the road. Critical factor. The Kickbike brand is the Porsche of the scooter industry in Europe, but it's largely unknown in the United States. After relocating to a stretch of the Florida coastline popular with tourists, Jordan was determined to bring kickbikes to the masses. Epic scavenger hunt becomes six-figure income. An event planner creates a competitive scavenger hunt game that takes place across Boston. Can you really make money while having so much fun? Chris Damianakos runs a scavenger hunt in Boston, Massachusetts. To understand where this seriously fun project began, we have to go back to the late 1980s, when teenage Chris was on a family trip in Greece. It was there that he witnessed a scavenger hunt being put on by an Italian tour group. He fell in love with the idea of playing a competitive game with other people using the world as a game board. Chris had grown up putting on tournaments and shows for his friends. When he got back to the United States, he designed his very first hunt. In the movie version of Chris's story, he would have gone straight from there to creating his own company. Instead, he finished high school and continued on to college, where he majored in marketing. After college, he got a series of jobs in event management, both as a freelancer and contracting for companies. But he never felt fully fulfilled. So a number of years later, he came back to the scavenger hunt idea that he loved so much when he was a teenager. As another passion project, he created an elaborate 6-hour-long hunt for his friends and family. They loved it. A friend that was in marketing couldn't stop talking about what a great business this could be. Chris then spent a few months redesigning the hunt so that it could be played in 2 hours instead of 6. The theory being that not everyone would be up for a 6-hour hunt, no matter how awesome it promised to be. He then launched his new venture, which he called Cash Hunt. Now, everyone thinks the name refers to a cash prize, but it's actually short for Chris Already, his wife's name, and Super Hunt. This project began in the dark ages, more than a decade ago when social media was just getting off the ground. Chris decided to place ads in the wedding party section of a local newspaper to see if he could attract bachelorette and bachelor parties. The plan worked, as his first group scavenger hunt was a bachelor party. He was simultaneously excited and petrified, since he had never done a hunt for the general public before. He charged them $30 per person, with an 8-person minimum, and the group was thrilled. That first year, he did 5 games and made a couple $1,000s. Since his initial investment was so low, the newspaper ads, materials for the game itself, and his time, most of what he made was pure profit. During that year, he also landed a wireless provider as a corporate client. The company asked him to customize the scavenger hunt for their employees. It took some figuring out, but after that first experience, he created a blueprint to make customization for future corporate clients easier. Even without specifically pursuing businesses, he continued to get 1 or 2 corporate clients a year who used his scavenger hunt as a team building outing. Since he customized hunts for each company, he charged them more per person and had a minimum of 10 participants instead of 8, with a cap of 250. Over the next few years, Chris kept advertising in newspapers. Because this was a side hustle and he wasn't dependent on the income, he enjoyed making the game as epic as possible. For example, he designed a fully interactive game that used the city of Boston as the board. Players start off with a comic book that has some initial challenges in it. They have to decide as a team how they're going to get the most points before the 2 hours are up. Sometimes challenges lead to point cards. Sometimes they lead to other challenges or scannable codes that send them to an online puzzle. At one point, he even created a prop that looked like a real newspaper. Players had to find it and then use it to complete the challenge. As he described it, "I wanted to make it as much like one of those reality TV shows as possible, so people could get that experience for an afternoon." Chris continued to put on more and more scavenger hunts and saw his revenue increase steadily, solely through word of mouth and newspaper ads. 4 years after starting, his annual part-time income was up to $30,000. And then his business started to take off even more, but not because of anything he did directly. Review sites like TripAdvisor and Yelp had gained momentum, and all of a sudden he was getting excellent reviews, furthering his word of mouth marketing in a more technological way. As his reputation on review sites grew, so did the business. He finally decided to jump into Cash Hunt full-time. Not only had his revenue gone up, but the increased volume of interest by way of phone calls, emails, and interactions on social media, which was now much more common, served as further confirmation. Once he decided to focus all his attention on the business, he started increasing the number of games in the Boston area. He invested in technology to add in additional interactive elements. Over the years, the prizes also got better, with each winner now receiving a medal. He switched to a commercial bank account to process credit card payments and stopped running newspaper ads in favor of online ads. He updated his website, bringing it forward nearly a decade into present-day standards. Over the years, Chris had been approached a few times about franchising Cash Hunt in other cities. He always deferred, instead making one-day round trips to other cities himself for corporate clients. But soon he was flying back and forth to Chicago so often that the commute was getting impractical. When he was once again approached about franchising, he finally considered the idea. He flew to each city to meet with the interested parties, scoped out the area, and entered into collaborative partnerships with existing tour companies in 5 different cities. It's been quite the journey since that first 6-hour hunt Chris made for his friends. He's now making well over 6 figures a year. He has one other full-time employee working with him in Boston and facilitators in several other locations. He also has plans in the works to expand further. Oh, and he's still having a lot of fun. Critical factor. A successful scavenger hunt is made up of 2 critical qualities, fun and organization. Chris brought both of them to Cash Hunt, refining the process along the way and continuing to improve from gig to gig. Side Hustle Labs, DIY event planning. In some ways, producing a successful event is like developing an online course. You need a reason to bring people together and the right venue or space for them to meet. But a conference, meetup, in-person class, or other event has at least one big difference: a fixed deadline that comes with other unchangeable variables. If no one signs up for your online course on ballroom dancing, you can try again later. But if no one shows up at a physical venue you've booked, you have a bigger problem. Right from the beginning, you'll need a clear plan for how you'll attract people to your event. This should include an easy way for them to sign up and pay in advance wherever possible, so that you know what to count on. If you can avoid paying for a venue for your first event, do so. Community centers, schools, and religious institutions that are often empty throughout the week can be good options. In some cases, bars and restaurants will be happy to host your group, especially if you commit to spending a minimum amount on food and beverages there. Make a simple projection of how many attendees you'll need for your event to be successful. Of course, you'll want more than the minimum standard of success, but this way you'll have a baseline goal. Perhaps most important of all, when it comes to events, publicity matters a lot. Shout it from the rooftops. For more, visit sidehustleschool.com/events. Chapter 7. Get crafty, get paid. If you have a penchant for a paintbrush or a love of making pottery, you might be able to turn your creations into money, just like the people in these stories did. Elementary school teacher pans for gold in New Zealand. After changing continents, an elementary school teacher finds true love, goes panning for gold in New Zealand, and ends up making an extra $40,000 in a year, working mostly on the weekends. For the past 12 years, Alex Moore has been an elementary school teacher. Originally from St. Louis, Missouri, he taught in the area for several years before moving overseas to London to continue teaching and to play rugby. While in London, he met his future wife, Paula. Once he visited her homeland of New Zealand to meet her family, he knew it was a match made in heaven, and not just with Paula, but with the country of New Zealand, too. On that first trip, Alex had a crazy idea. He'd heard it was possible to pan for gold in parts of the country, and his goal was to find enough gold to make his wedding ring. He spent about 20 to 30 hours pursuing this goal, but in the end, he only found about 2 grams of gold. You need about 20 grams to make a ring, so after all that work, he was only 10% there. Still, when he got home, he took the gold he'd found to a master jeweler who melted it down into his future ring. It was that process that led him to the side hustle that would change his life. While talking to the jeweler, Alex learned that he taught jewelry making on the side. On the spot, he signed up for lessons. He continued these lessons off and on for the next 2 years while he was teaching. After he'd learned enough, he was able to start making a few pieces of his own and sold them on Etsy. This took place for a few more years until he moved to New Zealand with Paula and their young family. Their new home base was Queenstown, a huge tourist destination that's known as the adventure sports capital of the world. Right on the banks of the gorgeous Lake Wakatipu, the creative Queenstown Arts and Crafts Market is held weekly, drawing in hundreds of tourists from all over the world. It was at this market that Alex began to get a lot more serious about his jewelry making. Alex took on the moniker Gold Pan Pete, and now sells both online and to tourists visiting the market. Most of his sales take place at the market, but he tends to get repeat customers who order more jewelry from him once they return home. During an average week, he makes about $800 in net income, or approximately $40,000 in a year. To be fair, he needs to be on-site selling at the market for 8 hours on Saturday, and then spend another 6 to 8 hours a week in his home workshop once his kids go to bed. Still, for $40,000 a year, it's worth it. He's currently expanding his online presence and hoping to develop more relationships with shops around the globe. This will allow him to work less, make more money, or both. Critical factor: Alex sells at a big international market that draws visitors from all around the world each weekend. Many of those visitors see his work at the market, then go home and place an online order. Oh, and this story has an action plan. Step 1, apprentice with a master jeweler or other craftsperson. Step 2, make your first jewelry and learn as you go. Step 3, specialize by crafting something unique. Some of Alex's bestsellers are rings featuring different house seals from Game of Thrones. Step 4, find the right tourist market. Pay close attention to what sells. Chances are, that's what you should focus on. And step 5, shift to online sales. In the long run, you'll be able to reach far more people than selling locally. Penny portraits of Abe Lincoln turn into $40,000. An investment broker earns an above-average return on an unusual art project. Do you have an extra $8.46 in pennies? Maybe you could put it to good use, creating a portrait of Abraham Lincoln. At least that's what Maury McCoy from Austin, Texas would suggest. Maury works in the investment world and spends much of his week pitching large endowments, foundations, and pensions. In industry terms, he's what's known as an independent third-party marketer. But that's his day job. When he's not at the office, Maury sells an Abraham Lincoln portrait kit that can be filled in with 846 pennies. The idea came about when he read a story about a father and son in Florida who had created a giant wall-sized portrait of Abe Lincoln made out of pennies. He loved the concept, but looking at the final portrait, he thought their execution left a little to be desired. He'd also been curious about the side hustle world, having previously tried different projects ranging from producing video games to helping out with his wife's crafty creations, and even unsuccessfully launching an app that he describes as a neat but unprofitable learning experience. Looking at that story about Honest Abe, he kept thinking about ways he could improve the image quality and also make it smaller. He couldn't resist tinkering. Within 15 minutes on his computer, he had a mock-up in Photoshop that looked decent. Then, in the nature of Photoshop editing, about 38 versions later, he finally had one he was satisfied with. At the time, he had no idea if anyone else would be interested in it. He didn't really do any market testing. He just thought it was a fun project and figured he'd give it a try. To get it going, he had to put down more than just pennies. He placed a print run of 2,000 units of his new Abe Lincoln template. The order size was this large because the printer setup cost $800, whether he printed one copy or 1,000. So he figured he might as well get the cost per unit as low as possible. He called his creation the Penny Portrait, and the pitch was simple. Create a portrait of Abraham Lincoln completely out of pennies. A buddy of his bought the very first kit, which helped him confirm that the online checkout system worked properly. To make his first real sales, he sent out a number of emails and posted on various message boards and forums. There were multiple target markets, so he dabbled a bit with them all. His early sales depended almost entirely on the effort he put into it, which was enjoyable at first, but then seemed like a lot of work. Fortunately, as time went on, sales began to happen more naturally. He also listed the penny portrait on Amazon, which has been a good source of consistent sales over time. Maury makes a profit of around $10 per unit, and to date, he's sold well over 4,000 penny portraits. In the beginning, he jokingly said to his wife that he wanted to be able to make enough to buy a Lincoln automobile from selling Lincolns made from little Lincolns. Before too long, he'd accomplished that goal. Not bad for a penny-pinching project. Critical factor. It's a fun project that people often do with their children or grandchildren. And the penny probably won't be around forever. Craftsman creates mobster-themed handcrafted wallets. After receiving custom requests from friends and family, a leather craftsman launches his own line of leather products. By day, Phil Callis works in development and operations at Horween Leather Company, a 114-year-old tannery in Chicago, Illinois. Working around leather all day is what inspired him to start his side hustle. He's constantly surrounded by hundreds of sheets of different colored and textured leather, and he wanted to create something he could use and appreciate every day. He started by making leather wallets and bags for himself out of the most unique styles of leather he came across. Soon, his friends started admiring his handiwork and wanted items for themselves. After a year of receiving compliments and requests, Phil and his good friend Dan Cordova, who's also in the leather business, decided to try making and selling their handcrafted leather products online. Since leather products require specialized tools and materials, there were some substantial startup costs involved in getting their new business off the ground. While they tried to keep costs as low as possible by working out of Dan's garage, they still had to purchase leather, hardware, sewing machines, hand tools, and books to keep educating themselves. All of this ran them around $5,000. One area where they were able to save money was in marketing. They put in very few paid marketing efforts, relying instead on word of mouth and their connections in the leather business. They created a website and got a bit of organic traffic through some very basic search engine optimization efforts. It was through those efforts that they got their biggest sale that first year. A large retailer in Asia placed a wholesale order through their website, which launched them with over $50,000 worth of wallets and accessories sold that year. In Phil's words, it was exciting, but exhausting. I stayed up late many nights and worked weekends to fill their wholesale order. They started simply with just one wallet, a card holder, and a purse that has since been discontinued. Each year or so, they add a new wallet style and a new accessory. 6 years in, they now have 8 wallet styles, plus belts, key cases, passport holders, and their own line of leather care products. They caught a big break when the owner of the tannery they worked for started up a specialty leather store in Chicago, and decided to stock their goods. With his expertise and authority in the leather industry, it gave Phil and Dan's new business a boost in credibility. As time went on, the marketing tactics for Ashland Leather have become more sophisticated. They now run their website through Shopify, publish a newsletter announcing weekly deals, and produce daily posts featuring their favorite leathers and manufacturing techniques. Another profitable strategy has been partnering with MassDrop, a company that cultivates communities where people with common interests can learn together. They've sold hundreds of wallets through this partnership. They've also done some collaborations a little closer to home. For example, the Chicago Comb Company wanted a leather sheath to cover one of their products. That product quickly took off and has resulted in an ongoing partnership with thousands of comb sheaths made and sold. These localized and virtual efforts have paid off in a major way. It wasn't long before they outgrew Dan's garage and needed to find a new place to work. Luckily, a space behind the tannery was available, and they moved everything there, where they still work today. Their first year in business, they had around 50 visitors per day to their website and just over $50,000 in sales. Now, they consistently have over 500 visitors a day with a conversion rate of 1.5% for about $350,000 worth of merchandise sold annually. While that sounds like a lot, their material costs are substantial. They also brought on two more craftspeople to help create the products. Finally, Phil's brother Matt helps with managing production and customer service. As much as they love the extra income, Phil and Dan also love that they get to create something that people are excited to buy. They enjoy the challenge of figuring out how to overcome new business hurdles, everything from choosing the best online store to how to tell the story of the leather and convey the right color with photography. Ultimately, the community they've created with their craftspeople, customers, and partners is what motivates them to keep creating products. Critical factor. There's no magic shortcut to making a high-quality leather product, but the consistency that Ashland Leather displays through its daily posts and weekly newsletter helps them with continued visibility. Carpenter pays his mortgage selling embroidered travel patches. Tired of look-alike flag patches, this carpenter and frequent traveler creates his own designs, selling them to fellow backpackers and collectors. By day, Mike Leckie works as a carpenter in Montreal, Quebec. His side hustle is Vagabond Heart, a company making vintage-inspired travel patches for people to sew on their luggage. When Mike was younger, he worked as a graphic designer and book editor. After becoming a carpenter, he missed some of the aspects of a desk job where he could sit down in clean clothes and work on a computer. But he didn't want to leave his current job. He just wanted the best of both worlds. He started his project so he could get his hands dirty during the day and then work on the computer in the evenings. It's essentially the opposite of people who have desk jobs and take on more DIY work as a hobby. Mike also likes to travel. He packs light, not wanting to bring a bunch of stuff home with him. His one consumer indulgence is collecting patches for his backpack, like many other travelers do, and for years he was disappointed with how they looked. The most common patches were boring country flags or other designs that looked like they came from a cheap souvenir shop. He wanted something that had a bit more style. Patches with a hip, modern look, but that included an unmistakable nod to the 1920s and 30s era of luxury travel. Not only was Mike unable to find anything like that while traveling, he couldn't even find it online when he got home. So he decided to make them himself. To get things going, Mike had a designer in mind, someone he'd found on Tumblr years earlier when working on another project. Next, he needed a manufacturer. He found about 20 embroidery shops on the online business directory Alibaba and requested quotes from them all. His main consideration, other than price, was to find a company that offered a small order size. He wanted initial orders of just 50 pieces of each design. Startup costs were low, $1,000 to have the patches designed and $500 to have them manufactured. The 2 months of planning and setting everything up was his least favorite part of the process, especially when he had to put money in with no idea if this would work or not. But he decided in advance that if necessary, he could afford to lose the money. He set a firm boundary to only spend the $1,500, and he found that this strategy reduced his stress. Once he had his patches ready, he began to sell them on both Etsy and a Shopify site he'd made. Etsy sells cute, hip, and handmade items, and Mike found that he got a lot of traffic through organic searches. After he put his store up, it fell to the back of his mind, so he was pleasantly surprised when he got that first ding on his phone announcing a sale. The patches sell for $7, about the price of a pint of beer, so when he made his first sale, he went out after work and promptly reinvested the profits. Mike made $75 his first month and $150 his second. And then he started marketing his patches using Etsy promoted listings, which are easy to turn on with the click of a button. The service lets you pay to have a particular listing show up more prominently in search results. By the fourth or fifth month, Mike was pulling in over $1,000 a month in sales from this strategy, a minimum number that continues to this day. His side hustle pays for his mortgage. In addition to patches, Mike started selling pin versions of his designs because people were asking for them. He also began working with a wholesaler who sold similar products. They have a network of stores that buy from them, and the patches are now found in a number of shops across the United States and Canada. Finally, he's trying out a new way of selling by hosting a booth at a Patches and Pins Expo, the largest flair event in the United States. This expo is attended by fans, artists, retailers, and wholesalers. With such a big world to cover, Mike's goal is to keep expanding the Vagabond Heart collection from his current 24 designs to at least 50 in the near future, and eventually 100. And, of course, he's planning more trips to find or create more patches. Critical factor: backpacking patches haven't been updated for decades. Mike's designs present a modern look that pays homage to the classic era of luxury travel. TV producer sells monogram scarves while riding subway. In pursuit of a handmade income source, this TV producer experiments with different items until she discovers what customers like the most. Kirsten LaGreco was a television casting producer at a big production company in New York City. Her side hustle, which recently became her full-time work, is called Rosa Gold. It's a handmade scarf brand that gives back, trying to wrap the world in a little more love, as she likes to say. She donates a percentage of profits to Pencils of Promise and Donors Choose because she's passionate about education, especially for young girls. Rosa Gold blossomed out of an Etsy store she opened as a testing ground for different ideas that were swirling around her head. She'd come up with an idea, order some sample materials, and then post a listing. She'd only produce that item again if it was getting a lot of views, favorites, and orders. Etsy taught her how to listen to her customers, and she'd pay attention to requests for custom orders, especially if two or more people asked for something. While in college, Kirsten had spent her nights and weekends working as a merchandiser, so she knew that putting items that weren't selling on a mannequin, or even just moving them around, could lead to them flying off the shelves. Since Etsy is entirely online, she decided to use the same concept by updating product images for items that weren't selling well. Monogrammed blanket scarves were the product that stuck. After a few years of occasional selling, she decided she wanted to go bigger than Etsy. She still lists products there, but she also migrated everything to its own site, added additional items, including bandanas and t-shirts, and started to build it into a brand. Startup costs were low. She spent just $250 at first, and then grew the project as organically as possible. Her inventory increased as her sales did, so growth was gradual for the first few years. As it grew into a real business, she began to upgrade to better machines and make other investments. When she first started, Kirsten bought wholesale products to resell, but she wanted to design her own, so she tested out manufacturers she found online. She started with a lot of cold emailing to scarf factories all over the world and eventually found suppliers she preferred. Because scarf sales are seasonal, Kirsten can sell as little as $1,500 of product a month and as much as $10,000 to $20,000. She's trying to incorporate more non-seasonal products and recently launched summer blanket scarves to increase sales in the warmer months. She was able to negotiate low minimums with the factory for those, so it wasn't a huge risk. And she's waiting to see what happens because, after all, trying new things is how she built this business. One day, Kirsten was on a train heading to work in Manhattan and received a flurry of notifications indicating that she'd sold $1,000 in scarves in a very short period of time. By the time she exited the train and walked 10 minutes to her office, she'd sold another $1,000. While silently freaking out at her desk, she checked her website analytics and saw that the deluge of orders was coming from a radio mention on a popular morning show. That day was crazy. She was sitting at work watching her phone explode, all while getting bombarded with customer messages and phone calls. By 9 a.m., she was completely out of inventory. She crafted an email to buyers saying that there'd be a two-week wait to receive the order, but only one person canceled. Kirsten's goal was to turn her side hustle into a full-time job, so she reinvested her profits into the business, upgrading and enhancing each element. One big lesson: Kirsten understood from the beginning that good photos were important, but she made a mistake in not having them done with a white background. This meant that she couldn't be included in a lot of product gift guides, which can make a big impact on sales. After making enough improvements and increasing sales to a sustainable level, Kirsten left her job to go all in. She continues to experiment, keeping an eye on what works best. Critical factor: Kirsten didn't know from the beginning that she was going to focus on scarves. Instead, she tested out different ideas, offered them for sale, and noticed what customers responded to the most. Then, over time, she began to specialize. The story also includes an action plan. Here we go, step one. If you're a crafty person, but aren't sure what kind of crafts to sell, follow Kirsten's model. Try a few different things and see what works. Step two, browse Etsy to see what's selling and make a list of possibilities. Step three, start with at least two different ideas so that you can compare each part of the process, the making and the selling. Step four, over time, see both what you enjoy most and what people respond to most. Last, step five, eliminate the less interesting and less profitable ideas. Do more of what works and begin to specialize in that. Hand-stamped feminist jewelry smashes the patriarchy. An Arkansas feminist finds a way to give voice to her beliefs, one hand-stamped bracelet at a time. Stacy Bowers works as a communications coordinator for an arts education nonprofit in Little Rock, Arkansas. On the side, she sells hand-stamped feminist jewelry, as well as some tote bags, shirts, and enamel pins. Stacy started her shop Bang Up Betty as a hobby, but it's grown into a solid brand that brings in at least $3,000 a month in net income. Bang Up Betty isn't Stacy's first side hustle. In first grade, she resold magazines from school to her neighbors. She's also done freelance graphic design, marketing, and writing gigs, all while working other jobs. When she worked for a magazine and wasn't allowed to write for other publications, she sold funny greeting cards she made by hand. The new project began when Stacy made jewelry for holiday gifts in the form of copper bracelets with four-letter acronyms such as OMFG and STFU. When her gift recipients were enthusiastic, she listed the bracelets for sale. Design ideas kept coming to her, and she got better and better at bringing them to life. As a next step, she decided to build her own website. At first, the website was merely informational, with all of her sales coming through Etsy. She designed it herself, which involved staying up long nights chatting with the Squarespace customer service team so she could figure things out without having to hire a web designer. A friend took portraits and initial product photos for the site, and Stacy borrowed a camera to take more. Eventually, she converted the site to an online shop. She wanted people who wore her designs to say they got them from Bang Up Betty, not from another site or platform. Among others, her designs have included these favorites: a Smash the Patriarchy shopping bag, a George Michael heart pin, and a necklace that simply reads Hot Mess. Stacy's materials range from chains and charms to rings and brass, and she gets them from more than a dozen suppliers. She stays on top of logistics by keeping her supplies in clear containers, so she's never surprised by being out of something. In fact, her workspace is cleaner than the rest of her home. It has to be, she says, in order to maintain order and peace while surrounded by a million little things that I have complete responsibility for. Finding the best suppliers was a process of trial and error. Stacy says she ordered a lot of bad chains before she found suitable ones, and stocked the wrong size metal before she figured out what she really needed. When she decided she wanted to branch out into apparel, the process was much smoother because she relied on a local printing business run by a couple of friends. The jewelry making itself is an organized process, consisting of stamping, polishing, drilling, assembling, and packing. Stacy makes a lot of items per week, but she breaks down the steps over several days so she doesn't feel completely overwhelmed. As long as it's not the Christmas season, she can maintain a healthy balance of work, side hustle, and play. In December, she's in full panic mode, waiting for the light at the end of the tunnel. That light arrives in January, when sales return to normal and she can take a big payoff for all of her hard work. In a recent year, Stacy made more than $40,000 from Bang Up Betty. She also purchased her first house, thanks in part to the extra money she makes. Last but not least, she's taken advantage of opportunities to give back. She recently donated 100% of the proceeds from a Strong as Hell bracelet to the Arkansas Women's Outreach. She also came up with a line of enamel pins for a website called The Outrage. Sales of the pins benefit the ACLU and other progressive causes. She's taking a stand for her beliefs and building something for herself at the same time. Critical factor: these pins and earrings with a mission have a clear target market that is both a demographic and a psychographic. Bang Up Betty's buyers tend to be millennial women who identify with progressive causes. By marketing specifically to them, Stacy stands apart from many other sellers making similar items. Retail store manager creates miniature stages for Batman. A man's accidental side hustle fulfills a long-held dream to make movie sets, just not in the way he first expected. During business hours, Jason Hout manages a large retail store. His climb in the retail sector took him from Kansas City to Chicago to the Mall of America for companies like Fossil and Eddie Bauer. After 8 years, he returned home to settle down. Jason had grown up using his hands and imagination to fix cars and houses alongside his dad. He was also a huge movie fan, fascinated in particular by anything miniature. He'd imagined himself making miniature sets for the movie industry, but set the dream aside to become a star in retail. He didn't set aside his love of movies or miniatures, however. He discovered the world of 1/6 scale miniature figures from movies and television, where collectors purchased mini replicas of popular superheroes and action stars. Batman was his favorite. The process of creating the figures requires a long back and forth between the studios and the companies who create them. The figures have to be as exact as possible, especially in Asia, where this is a billion-dollar business. The manufacturers typically post pre-production photos of the characters online and then take pre-orders from fans. It's common to wait 6 to 9 months for delivery, with limited runs. Collecting 6-scale figures isn't a cheap hobby. The figures range from about $150 to well over $1,000. With such an investment at stake, Jason thought that collectors could do a better job in displaying their prized figures. Most of the time, the figures are placed on stands, as if in a museum. He felt that the figures deserved more. After all, many of them were based on superheroes. He wanted to place them in a scene from their movie. So, working in his off hours, he started building 6-scale miniature movie sets. His Kansas City basement became his studio. He loved building things again, just as he'd done as a kid. He also enjoyed the process of sourcing objects to replicate different movie scenes. The plumbing and electrical aisles at home improvement stores became an adventure in reimagining how one thing could be used for another, and the wires inside thrift store radios added a nice touch. By coincidence, one of the country's top distributors of 6-scale figures, Time Walker Toys, was only 3 blocks from Jason's home. The staff there encouraged his interest in designing dioramas and featured one of his scenes at a comic convention. Jason's excitement over his dioramas inspired him to post photos of them on Instagram. This caught the eye of other collectors, who asked him to create scenes for them. His first commission was for the holding cell scene from The Dark Knight, which prompted 4 more of the same order within 5 days from other customers who saw the photos. His basement became an assembly line. Because all figures are 12 inches tall, Jason knows the exact proportions for each scene. It usually takes him 2 weeks to a few months to complete a diorama, and he often has a waiting list that stretches to 4 months or longer. Collectors are used to pre-orders and long wait times for the figures themselves, so they don't balk at waiting for their scenes. Jason collects a deposit to secure a customer's place in line. Once he begins building a diorama, he sends photos to the customer as the scene is created. While he invites input from buyers, he makes it clear that he has final creative license. He demonstrated this when a customer wanted to increase the length of an item by 2 centimeters. Not possible. Once a scene is completed, Jason sends it to the customer. He asks them to place the figure in the scene, take a photo, and post it to Facebook. This is the official reveal, and once he sees the figure in the set he designed, the scene is a wrap. The dioramas cost an average of $300, and Jason admits he could probably charge more without upsetting customers. He doesn't want his side hustle to take over all his personal time, so he's content to let customers find him through referral. In fact, until recently, he didn't even have a website, taking all of his orders as a response to requests on Instagram. After making more than 100 miniature stages, he finally decided to set up an online store. He's got something to plan for. Jason and his wife are expecting their first child, and his side hustle profits are going toward a much-needed savings fund. His big dream of making miniature movie sets ended up coming true, just in a different way than he expected. He now has that basement assembly line, something to look forward to after work, and a money-making side hustle. Critical factor. Going where the money is can be a wise strategy, and you can't be a collector of most items without spending money. Jason's miniature movie sets meet a clear need for collectors hoping to show off their valuable figures. Side Hustle Labs. How to sell your art, crafts, or handiwork. If you like to get crafty, there are lots of places online where you can sell your creations. The key is to go where the buyers are, not just where a lot of other artists and makers hang out. If you're not sure where your buyers might be, start with Etsy, the world's largest marketplace of handcrafts. And keep these tips in mind. Great photos go a long way. Not a photographer? Ask a friend with a good camera to help. Include multiple shots from different angles. And if you're selling clothing or jewelry, include images of how it looks on someone. Tell a story. Whenever you have the chance to sell something, you also have the chance to write a description. Make it a good one. go into lots of detail and tell people why you made whatever you're selling. Respond quickly to inquiries. If possible, a one-hour response time is best. It builds trust and confidence, and it also encourages buyers to make a purchase. Don't give them too much time to wander off and find something else they like better. Last, ask for reviews. Follow up with customers and ask them to review you on the site they purchased from. This makes a big difference, especially in the beginning. Social proof matters a lot. We want to know that other people like us were happy with their order. For more, visit sidehustleschool.com/crafty. Chapter 8, Automate Your Income. Earn money while you sleep is the ultimate promise. And for these people, it's part of their daily routine. These stories illustrate how working smarter, not just harder, can help you create systems that will pay out over and over. The Snuggle is Real. Architect moonlights by selling designer onesies. An architect creates minimalist, typographic onesies and t-shirts for his own kids, then turns it into a profitable side hustle without stocking any inventory. By day, Gerald Lau is an architect in Sydney, Australia. He's a fan of clean lines, lots of white, and simple typography. Like a lot of people, he enjoys his job, but also wants to diversify his income. He had previously tried a couple of projects that didn't work out. The first was selling designer stationery and homeware online. Since he handled his own inventory, it was hard for him to find time to keep up with stock, fulfill orders, and do the marketing needed to grow the business. Next, he tried doing interior design gigs on the side, but it felt just like working overtime. His architecture job often requires long hours, and he needed a gig that he could fit into the cracks of his day. Quick side note, it's usually important to do something different for your side hustle than you do for your day job. You want it to be work that brings you energy, not tires you out. Gerald is a regular listener to Side Hustle School, and an episode about print-on-demand businesses caught his interest. It inspired him to develop an idea he had to create timeless, minimalist t-shirts for kids. He named his new idea the Typo Tees. Startup costs were cheap, a domain name and a Shopify subscription, which helped keep the running costs low. He used a third-party service called Printly that would take care of all the printing and shipping. All of his products are made in the United States and they ship worldwide, choices Gerald was able to make when he set up his online shop. But what would he sell? He knew he had to stand out somehow. Gerald decided to specialize in alphabet onesies and t-shirts, featuring the first letter of a kid's first or last name. The initial results were as lackluster as his previous attempts, and nothing much happened. It took a few weeks before Gerald got his first order, for 6 shirts. That was nice, but not nice enough to suggest that the project would continue long-term, especially when that customer wasn't happy with the shirts and wanted her money back. The mishap got worse when his supplier wouldn't give Gerald a refund, and he had to pay for it from his own pocket. Plus, he forgot to ask for the shirts back before refunding the customer, and she never returned them. Oops. Gerald learned from the experience, put it in perspective, and moved on. At first, he was worried that something was wrong with the printer. But then he decided that quality wasn't the problem, it was just an unhappy customer. He had done his best in choosing a partner and decided to continue with them. If any other problems developed, he could always look for a different printer later. One of the best things about print-on-demand is that there's no need to stock any inventory. Products are printed as people order them, and if you're the seller, you may never even see them. This gave Gerald the ability to expand his designs with absolutely no cost. All he had to do was post new designs and see what people put in their shopping carts. He added simple, typeface-inspired graphics that featured playful messages with a clean aesthetic. As he broadened his designs, more people began buying the onesies and shirts, and fortunately, these customers were happy with the product. They loved dressing their kids in something that was personalized for them, like the first letter of their name. Gerald also added companion onesies and shirts to encourage multiple product purchases. One customer favorite is a onesie that reads, "The Snuggle is Real," with a companion t-shirt for moms and dads that reads, "The Struggle is Real." Next, he added a customizable feature to his site. A customer can choose from 5 fonts and put in any message they would like. Thanks to the wonders of print-on-demand, the turnaround time from order until shipping is only 24 hours. Gerald says the best part of having a side hustle like the Typo Tees is getting photos from happy customers and their kids wearing those onesies and t-shirts. He advises anyone thinking of going into online clothing sales to be sure they do something different to stand out. It's a saturated market, and anything you can think of has probably been done before in some shape or form. He also advises you to not expect a positive return overnight. These kinds of projects tend to need time and experimentation. The struggle, or the snuggle, is real, but the rewards can be worth it. Critical factor. It's easy to start a print-on-demand shop, but not so easy to profit from it. Because the barrier to entry is so low, a lot of people are trying to compete. Gerald saw success and reached his first four-figure month when he began to specialize in creative designs for kids' t-shirts and onesies. Action plan. All right, another action plan. Five steps here. Step one, print-on-demand is easy to start, yet hard to master. To stand out, experiment with different ideas. Step two, identify your product. What will you sell? People who are successful at it tend to niche down, like Gerald has done. Step three, choose a service that will print and ship your orders. In addition to the one mentioned in this story, there are many other options. Step four, once you have a supplier, build a basic website using Shopify or another platform. And step five, when orders come in, do nothing, because your print-on-demand supplier will handle it all. Nice. Philadelphia design lover maps out extra income. A neuroscientist turned marketing manager moonlights as an artist, selling original paper-cut designs with very little marketing. After what she calls a strange career jump from neuroscientist to marketing director, along with a few bad breakups along the way, Emma Fried Casserla found herself in the midst of an existential crisis. She loved her new job, but felt a strong urge to make something that showed off her artistic side. In order to jump into extracurricular creative activities, Emma set herself a challenge. She'd create a paper-cut map of the city of Philadelphia. A paper-cut involves making precise incisions into paper to remove all the sections that don't look like what you're trying to make. She had spent a lot of time with a scalpel performing experiments as a neuroscientist and felt her skills would transfer perfectly. For the next 3 months, Emma spent her evenings and weekends working on what she called her 4x3 project. She documented her progress on a blog, Philly Love Notes, and through its associated Instagram account. Once the project was completed, and on the recommendation of a friend, she scanned the finished work into her computer. Little did she know that this labor of love would go on to become a project that earned tens of thousands of dollars a year in mostly passive income. In the following weeks, Emma generated some buzz around the project by offering a giveaway where people could enter to win the original map. She also shared the smaller map she'd made for friends by laser printing her design into pieces of wood. The response was overwhelming, and people began requesting their own custom maps through comments and direct messages. To manage her business and the sudden influx of orders, Emma took her new craft business online, setting up shop and using the same name as her blog. She says that Etsy is the only real tool she uses to run the business, because it lets her handle both the front and back ends in one easily accessible interface. On the one hand, it's a storefront she can refer people to with a simple link. On the other, it allows her to process and manage sales. And being a scientist at heart, she also has a manual spreadsheet that she maintains as backup documentation. Custom maps make up around 95% of Emma's monthly orders. But while for most businesses, custom means a lot of extra work, Emma has managed to refine it to a relatively painless process. The original design that she scanned onto a computer forms the basis of all her orders. It's essentially a customizable template, and she can edit it, chop it up, and change it around to meet the needs of any custom order, all without having to spend any more months hunched over a piece of paper. She takes these custom files to her local art space, NextFab, where they're printed onto pieces of wood and then sanded down to be ready to ship. She's got it down to a weekend ritual that she completes nearly every week of the year. The ease of this process helped Emma keep her startup cost extremely low. She invests $129 into her NextFab membership per month, an additional $15 to $35 per hour for laser time, and nominal amounts for the wood or craft paper for each map. Each piece will then retail in a range of $50 for the smallest size and $350 for the largest, with a small premium for a custom order. The main marketing channel for her work has been Instagram. She has more than 55,000 followers, which she's attracted through curating a feed solely about Philadelphia. Here she shares photographs that local people and travelers love and uploads images of her maps once every 2 weeks. Whenever she does, she always sees an immediate spike in sales. The second biggest driver of sales is word of mouth. Because of the uniqueness of her designs, she has a constant stream of people coming to her to see how much it would cost to have their own map made. This means that, aside from that bi-weekly social media update, Emma puts little effort into getting her maps in front of new customers. At some point, they just started to sell themselves. Since her initial 3 months of work several years ago, the sales of these maps has earned her an average of $35,000 annually, Because she views her side hustle as a project and not a business, Emma has been able to avoid the need for constant expansion. That said, she would like to organically grow her brand and its designs to other cities. If you've got a request, check out her shop and let her know where you live. Critical factor. Emma's project and popular Instagram feed focuses entirely on her city. She only posts photos of her maps every 2 weeks, but whenever she does, she sees an immediate boost in sales. Australian creates passive income from anatomy course. He didn't know much about human anatomy, but he created the definitive online course to help med students master its vocabulary. After making no updates to it for 4 years, it still brings in $800 a month. For the past 8 years, Mike Benkovich in Sydney, Australia, has earned an average of $800 a month for a project he's barely touched since first creating it. He hasn't improved it, and he hasn't done much to maintain it. It just keeps paying out month after month. The project is an online audio course that helps medical students memorize the human anatomy. Mike didn't make the course because he was a med school student himself or because he was especially knowledgeable about anatomy. He made it because he thought other people might be interested in paying for it. Here's how he did it. Before actually creating the product itself, he wrote a pitch for it. The pitch explained the benefits of the product as well as the problem that it would solve. In short, he promised to help students learn through mnemonics without having to come up with potentially hundreds of them on their own. Then he tested the offer. He made a one-page website with a few stock images and included a mailing list at the bottom where interested students could sign up to learn more. When they signed up, they received a message that said, "Unfortunately, we are upgrading Anatomonics right now." That's the name of the product. "So it's unavailable for order. We will email you shortly once the system has relaunched." The entire purpose of the testing site was to see if people would really be interested in the product. But of course, he didn't have a product at that point. He had to make it. Notice the order of these events. He didn't start with making the product. He focused first on clarifying who it was for and then verifying the existence of a market for it. To make that product, he got creative. He hired 2 people from a freelancing website, a researcher and a voiceover actor. The researcher's job was to collect the data that the voiceover actor would then record. Mike reviewed everything before the actor recorded it, and he also updated the site to accept payments from customers. The whole process took about 2 months. Once it was ready, Mike went back to his initial test audience and offered them the product for sale at a 50% discount. There were just 30 people in that group, but 10 of them took the deal, earning him $600. That was a great start, and to make sure the customers would keep coming, he made a series of short online videos. He also posted some articles about anatomy on the site over the next few months, improving its Google rankings and drawing in new students. Before long, he was making at least a few $100s a month with almost no marketing and minimal customer support. A few months later, he made a very smart decision. He added price tiers, giving customers 3 options to choose from when purchasing the course. This one action increased his average order by $25 without affecting the conversion rate, and he was soon earning $800 a month without much effort. So, what did he do next? Did he get more serious about the business, growing it to 6 figures by working on it night and day? Nope. He got bored and moved on to other projects. It happens. But before he got bored, he arrived at this plateau that has never changed, at least not significantly in all those years. The business is somewhat seasonal because students are more active in their studies during certain times of year, but the annual income is consistent. His profit margin is virtually 100% because there are almost no expenses now that the product has been made. At the time we first profiled him on the show, it had all added up to something like $67,000 that arrived over time. And of course, the payments continue to arrive month after month. It's been an incredible return on investment for something he knew nothing about when he started. Critical factor. Mike's anatomy course served a specific group of people that didn't have access to anything similar. It's also an evergreen topic. Not much changes in the world of anatomy from year to year. Coupon code site coins copious profits. A marketer for a retail company sits on a domain name for more than a decade before finally turning it into a website that earns ongoing affiliate commissions. Ever search for an online coupon code? Many people have, and a lot of them have been frustrated by codes that are expired or otherwise inactive. Enter Antonella Pisani. Her side hustle was a long time coming, 12 years to be precise. That's when she first bought the domain officialcouponcode.com. At the time, she was working in marketing for a major retailer and saw a growing number of people making money through that retailer's affiliate program. She had grabbed the domain because she wanted to cash in on this revenue stream herself, with a coupon site that was more customer-friendly than average, one with no expired deals or codes that didn't work. However, the project wasn't meant to be, at least not for a number of years. She was so busy with her day job that she didn't have time to do anything with it, so it just sat there. Then, 4 years ago, she happened to mention to some coworkers that she owned the domain, and they basically told her she was crazy for not doing something with it. Right around this time, Antonella had also decided to strike out on her own and start a digital marketing agency. She took some time off to travel as she transitioned to working for herself, and during the trip, she made a plan to finally build a site. The first thing she had to do was decide on a platform. After testing out a few options, she settled on a WordPress coupon theme that had all the features she was looking for, with plenty of room to grow. She did a lot of customization as she built out the website, mostly using free and paid plugins. She hired a friend to design her logo for a few $100s and slowly started creating a more polished brand. With the base website in place, she needed a way to import and maintain deals that didn't involve her manually inputting data. Again, she did some testing. After trying a few free plugins, she opted to pay for a feed service that provides real-time information. If you're curious, the service is called FMTC, which stands for Me to Compete. At anywhere from $500 to $2,000 per month, the service doesn't come cheap, but it has real people behind it testing each offer and providing quality content. From there, it was time to start applying to be an affiliate with as many retailers as possible. As Antonella shared, the affiliate industry is a chicken or egg game. Retailers won't let you into their programs if you don't have traffic or sales on the network, but it's tough to get traffic and sales without good retailers. It really didn't matter that I had just come off of being an executive at several large companies. I still had to do a fair amount of groveling early on. Eventually, she made her way onto multiple affiliate networks and now works with half a dozen of them. Once she had her first affiliate partnership set up, she wanted to invest in a copywriter to help build out content for various store pages. But that got expensive quickly. Luckily, she learned about Fancy Hands, a US-based virtual assistant service, and was able to outsource some research and writing to them for much cheaper. The goal was to strike the right balance between providing useful content and discounts for customers while also ranking well in search engine results. Oh, and she needed to do it all without burning through a ton of cash. With the key elements in place, Antonella was ready to get the word out, which started by using social media to tell her friends. With her background in corporate marketing, she also knew to distribute press releases to media outlets. This tactic worked well and ended up getting her press on sites like Engadget, Entrepreneur, and The Street, all of which drove high-quality traffic to her website. A more unique marketing tactic was especially helpful. She ran a scholarship contest for undergraduate students, both to give back and promote her new business. Each year, one student is awarded a few $1,000s. An official coupon code gets some great press in a variety of different media outlets. For all her efforts, official coupon code cleared five figures in net income during year one. While she spent a fair amount of money getting the website set up and paying for the content to flesh out the site, that initial investment has more than paid off. The next year, she saw more than a 300% increase in both traffic and referral fees. Antonella knows that the key to generating more revenue is continually updating the website with custom content, new links, new deals, and new retailers. That's why she's happy with her decision to use a service to help her update all that data. Since this is purely a side hustle for her, Antonella thinks of the website as a long-term investment and a nice source of income for her frequent trips. Her focus has now shifted to a new project, and this one can continue to pay dividends even as she does other things. It took more than a decade, but she's glad she decided to dust off that domain name and put it to work. Critical factor. It's frustrating to search for deals online, only to find coupon codes that don't work. Antonella's site promises no expired codes, generating loyalty in an industry where most visitors are merely clicking around with no intent to return. And this story includes an action plan. Step one, to be successful with this kind of project, you'll need two things: relationships with affiliate managers and traffic that will click their links. Step two, review some other coupon code sites. Identify merchants or directories and request approval to list their links. Step three, find a source that provides updated coupon codes on a regular basis. It's also possible to search for codes on your own. It just takes a lot of time. And step four, build your site and attract traffic. This is easier said than done, of course, but ultimately it's the only key to success with a project like this. So if you can figure it out, you're in business. Successful artist adds $1,000 a month to his income. An artist uses his love of whimsical drawing to create a side hustle, selling everything from autographed prints to coffee mugs with his designs on them. From his studio on beautiful Vancouver Island, the artist Mark Johns creates and sells artwork